May it please the court. The district court's judgment in this case should be reversed for two primary reasons. The jurisdictional position that New Jersey's Attorney General took below is wrong and contradictory. It's wrong because under the Due Process Clause, Gerber Graywall did indeed purposely avail himself of Texas by literally becoming the Attorney General of Texas, censoring Texas speech that was of, by, and for Texans. Now, we will hold fast to that proposition because it accords not just with the first principles of personal jurisdiction, but also with the governing precedents of the United States Supreme Court and this court. Now, I think it would be a disservice for me to stand up here today and just pound the podium and say Calder as many times as I can. And I likewise think it would be a disservice if my friend on the other side pounds the table and says Stroman as many times as he can. The court's task is to navigate those precedents and reconcile them. We can do that, and Graywall can't. But that is not our strongest argument, and that is not the simplest reason to reverse. The strongest and simplest argument is the contradiction, the estoppel argument. Gerber Graywall should not have been allowed to take the position that he took below, because in the Washington case, he took the opposite position and used it to his advantage. And that's where we'd like to begin the argument today, is with estoppel. This is a paradigm case of gamesmanship, trying to have it both ways just because one litigant likes one court better than another and is trying to engage in forum shopping. Your Honor, we'll be happy to yield the remainder of our uninterrupted time and accept questions whenever the court is ready to lodge them. And I'll begin the estoppel argument by saying what we're not arguing. We're not arguing a full-fledged preclusion argument. That is, we're not arguing that the court in Washington actually rendered a holding about who can and cannot be sued in Texas. The reason we're not making that argument is because we don't need to make that argument. The estoppel argument applies not just to the bottom line holdings that a court renders and not just to the bottom line conclusions that a litigant takes. It applies both to what you would think of as a court judgment and the court's opinion and its holdings. It applies not just to the bottom line position that Graywall asserted, but also the positions that are necessarily entailed. And so the position we say he took in Washington is that website control equals minimum contacts. Now, for a long time in this litigation, Graywall denied taking any position whatsoever. And you see in the 11th hour letter we get last week, Graywall admits the following, that he did argue in the alternative that Defense Distributed had minimum contacts with Washington. There are two problems with that. We'll accept the concession insofar as it goes, but the problems are that, number one, it wasn't in the alternative. He took that position in the first instance, and that's only half the position. I think if we determine anything in today's argument, we should have counsel for Graywall finish the sentence. He says Defense Distributed had minimum contacts with Washington because there has to be a reason that there are minimum contacts, and there is only one reason. There's only one way to finish that sentence, and that finish is that Defense Distributed controlled the website. In that case, in the Washington case, the only thing at issue is website publications, and you'll see from the very get-go, not just later in summary judgment briefings, Document 1 filed in the case is the complaint. Document 1 says in paragraph 13 that the court has personal jurisdiction over the parties. Document 1 says in paragraphs 4 through 6 that Defense Distributed's only relationship with Washington is that it turns the switch on the website and broadcasts a website from Texas to the entire world. You can see in paragraph 21 of the complaint where Graywall says to the court in Washington, Defense Distributed is a necessary party. So that's the position that he necessarily took, is that minimum contacts exists because Defense Distributed is controlling the website. And the reason that that contradicts the position here is because the jurisdictional keystone is the same. What we're talking about in both cases is a jurisdictional debate about website control. In this case, we say Graywall is subject to personal jurisdiction in Texas because he shut down the website, because he wants to censor the website. He put his hand on the switch and took it down by sending that cease and desist letter into Texas. Now, what we have in Washington is just the flip side. That's litigation about people that refuse to censor the website. They refuse to take it down and refuse to flip the switch down. There, they're suing the federal officials because the federal officials aren't willing to censor this website. So vis-a-vis Defense Distributed and Graywall, you have two sides of the same coin. In Washington, Graywall says Defense Distributed can be sued because they control the website. If that's true, he loses the case below, because he did that and more here. The contradiction is evident, and he profited from it. He advantaged from it in Washington in at least four ways. He got the temporary restraining order. He got the preliminary injunction. He got an order holding that Defense Distributed is a necessary party to that litigation, and he got the final judgment. Now, I know one of the arguments Raywall has is that later in the Washington litigation, there's a dispute about waiver and whether the issue of personal jurisdiction was litigated to the T there. We disagree. We have lots of answers about that, but the court doesn't even have to get there. We can show you the advantage that Graywall got with that position in 2 days of litigation. Day one, he filed the complaint. Day two, he got the temporary restraining order. If ever there is a scenario, and when courts are supposed to apply this doctrine with vigor, it's that scenario. Where we're talking about the nationwide injunction blitz strategy, where a litigant goes into court and says to the court, this is our complaint. They ask for a TRO to be issued the next day, and they get it. The court absolutely relied on that filing, and that is precisely the kind of advantage that triggers judicial estoppel. So the precedence we have for this is one that we cite and one that they cite. The New Hampshire case, when the United States Supreme Court tells you that the judicial estoppel doctrine is implicated not just by express bottom-line holdings of a court decision, but also by implied reliance. If a court impliedly relies on some representation a litigant has made, the doctrine applies. You also get that same rule from this court's Hall decision, which Judge Jones was on and will recall. That's cited in their brief. If the court will indulge me, I'll read two pieces from Hall that I think are instructive and worthwhile. First is on the question of whether, in order for estoppel to apply, you need a final decision as opposed to a preliminary decision. And Hall says that either will suffice. If they even derive an advantage at a preliminary stage, that's enough. The quote from Hall is as follows. The previous court's acceptance of a party's arguments could be either as a preliminary matter or as a final disposition. So we have both in this case, and either will suffice to get across the line. The second thing that Hall talks to is this issue of express reliance and an express holding, something that resolves a dispute on the merits, as opposed to simply an advocate making a representation that they know the court will need to rely upon. And Hall stands for the proposition that that second kind, that implied reliance, is enough to satisfy judicial estoppel. Here's the quote I want to read to you. The judicial acceptance requirement does not mean that the party against whom the judicial estoppel doctrine is to be invoked must have prevailed on the merits. Instead, what the court says is, quote, doctrine may be applied whenever a party makes an argument with the explicit intent to induce the district court's reliance. When Graywall went to the court in Washington, filed the complaint, asked for the TRO, similarly, when he asked for the preliminary injunction, the whole case is predicated on the notion that Defense Distributed is a necessary party and that they have personal jurisdiction over Defense Distributed. Now, my friend today, I think, is going to stand up and try to finish the sentence and say that the state of Washington, Defense Distributed has minimum contacts with the state of Washington because, and his only answer to that question can be that they have minimum contacts because Defense Distributed controlled the website. That's exactly what happened in this case in Texas. The same jurisdictional keystone exists in both cases. And so at bottom, what you have is gamesmanship, trying to have it both ways. And this is really indeed a clear case of forum shopping.
Well, Mr. Flores, why weren't you able to persuade Judge Pittman about that?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
I say apparently you did not persuade Judge Pittman. Right, Pittman about this.
Right, I didn't because I think Judge Pittman took the view that the only thing that matters is the holding. I think Judge Pittman may have mistaken our argument for one of full-fledged preclusion. Right, he tried to ask the question, did the court in Washington render a holding about who can be sued in Texas? And it didn't. That was dispositive for him, but that's not the answer under the estoppel doctrine. The estoppel doctrine looks at the position that the litigant took, and you don't actually have to have litigated there. If we had litigated it in the state of Washington, then we'd be making a preclusion argument. But these are entirely separate doctrines that proceed for entirely separate reasons. Remember, preclusion is designed to protect mostly the litigants. The judicial estoppel doctrine is designed to protect the courts. It serves different interests. And so that's why most of my argument here today is focusing on what Graywall said to the court in Washington and what the court had to necessarily rely on when it issued the TRO and when it issued the preliminary injunction.
Okay. Do my colleagues have questions since he opened himself? Judge Elrod? Yes. I was wondering if I understand your distinction of Stroman. Is your distinction that this cease and desist letter is not limited to the New Jersey residents and property? It extends to Texas residents and Texas property as well? So it's not similar in that way. Is that your argument, or is it something different?
We have that argument and more, Your Honor. So that argument we call the letter focus argument. You'll see that we think this case fits under Calder and not Stroman because the letter focuses on Texas, both with respect to what it talks about and where the impact is felt. And what you just described is the letters, what the letter talks about. Right here, the letter is talking about a website in Texas. It's talking about shutting down that website and silencing people that are all in Texas. And so we think the letter's focus is Texas, both in what it's addressing, the actual computers that they flip the switch and tell the website to publish are in Texas. And so any reader of the letter that Graywall sent is going to understand it that way. Now, we don't dispute that the letter certainly pays lip service to the notion that Gerber Graywall is trying to help New Jersey and advance New Jersey interests by doing this. But the gist of the letter, the focus of the letter, is absolutely Texas. And we think it's more so than the letter in Stroman. Recall that in Stroman, the dispute was about Arizona real estate properties, and the letter says, stop doing things that affect Arizona real estate, stop doing things that affect Arizona citizens. Now, we don't deny that the letter in Stroman also had some Texas implications because there were people in Texas. And that's why I say our distinction isn't going to be the most beautiful distinction in the world. I think the court is cabined a little bit by difficult precedent, but there is a spectrum, and our letter is much more Texas-focused than the letter in Stroman. I have two other distinctions. So one of the distinctions is about the kind of cause of action involved. Recall that in Calder itself and in Calder as the court recapitulated it in Walden, the cause of action's uniqueness matters. It matters, right, that the libel cause of action in Calder was something that has its impact in the message itself, that it's felt by the people and their relationships around them. The censorship cause of action for chilling speech is like that, right? The letter itself is the actionable wrongdoing. Now, my friend on the other side, his best answer, he says, to Calder, he agrees that Calder applies if the message itself is the actionable wrongdoing, but he denies that in this case, the message itself is the actionable wrongdoing. He's just wrong about that.
Could I ask a follow-up about this? This is not just limited to the website, though. This is any type of publication, right? So being in the library, you could put it on a T-shirt. You could hand out pamphlets or yard signs, et cetera. Am I correct, or is that wrong?
No, you're correct. We understand his position to be that any publication of this information violates New Jersey law. That's both on the Internet. We also had, before Graywall dropped the hammer, we had a practice of mailing these files on USB drives. That is stopped. There is a brick-and-mortar library in Austin, Texas that used to publish these matters. That now is covered by Graywall's law. So it isn't just the Internet. It's essentially a total speech crime that bans everything.
My last question is this, this is already on the Internet, all over the Internet, isn't it?
It is, Your Honor. That leads right into our third.
Other places.
That's right. So our third distinction is that you could maybe construe Stroman as a case where the state official was actually enacting a policy that is uniform nationwide. That is not this case. This is a targeting case, and we don't just infer that from the letter. We have specific record proof that it's a targeting case. Remember that Graywall stood at the podium and said he's going after, quote, a Texan named Cody Wilson. And one of the claims in this case is selective prosecution. The whole point is that Defense Distributed published this information online already. Thousands of other people publish this same information online every day right now, and he's not going after them. So this isn't a side point. This is a crux of the case. And so if we want to distinguish Stroman, we can say, fine, if a state official really does uniformly apply some policy and go to all 50 states equally, and maybe that would be a Stroman case. We have some other quibbles with that theory, but just set it to one side. This isn't that case because there's targeting of just Defense Distributed, just Cody Wilson, the Texan that Graywall called out by name. And so if anything fits into the Calder model, it's that. I think the challenge for the other side is to say, in this case, if this kind of targeting evidence doesn't fit, doesn't get us into Calder, what does, right? They can't explain why this case fits into Stroman without rendering Calder a dead letter. I think that's the critical proposition.
Judge Higginson, you have questions?
Yes, I would love to ask them. Do I have time? May I go ahead?
Sure, we'll give a little extra time.
Okay. I have three questions. One is legal, one is factual, and one is rule of law. I did read the district court hearing, and it did seem like a showdown between Calder and Strowman. But, of course, Strowman does interpret and distinguish Calder. My reading is Strowman's been cited positively over 500 times, including the treatises, saying that it stands for the proposition that the Texas long-arm statute does not extend to defendant officials. What is your best or any federal court case where in outcome, not dicta, a defendant official was obliged to defend its state's laws in another state?
I don't have that case, Your Honor. The argument, as I understand it from the other side, is that Strowman renders that holding, and Strowman doesn't render that holding to defeat that position.
Do you have any case where a defendant official was obliged to defend that state's law, federal case? And the reason I'm focused on it is you cite heavily Backpage. But Backpage, of course, the Dallas-headquartered Backpage, actually goes and sues where the Cook County Sheriff is in Northern District of Illinois.
Mm-hmm. So, Your Honor, I don't have one at my disposal, but I'm confident that we can supply one, and we'll
okay.
have to do so.
I'm not interrupting out of rudeness. I just have so little time, and this is a difficult case. You know, you've done it all. You've been litigating all over the country. My fact question, the cease and desist letter here, and this is because if we were to distinguish Strowman, it might have to do with what the letter says. The first sentence does say stop publishing, quote, for use by New Jersey residents. Nowhere do I see the word Texas in the letter. So it's hard for me to say that New Jersey's trying to have its brunt and focal point be on Texas opposed to anywhere in the country.
So we would have two answers. Number one, Texas appears on the letter in the address. That's where they sent and delivered the letter, and the sides don't dispute that. So they delivered it into Texas. And our position is that even though the letter pays lip service to New Jersey, any reasonable reader in these circumstances can only understand the letter to mean one thing, shut down the website. If Graywall doesn't want this to mean shut down the website, have him say so today, because that will be a dramatic shift in the litigation.
Yep. And if I may, my last question, and I appreciate your succinct answers. I was on a panel in 2016, and again, you guys may be so cognizant of our case law, you'll know the case, even though I acknowledge it's not in the table of authorities, but it came right to my mind. It was Google versus Hood. And the panel there overturned Google's First Amendment preliminary injunction against the Mississippi Attorney General, who was threatening Google that their internet content was in violation of Mississippi law. Now, would the rule of law you're urging us to adopt, the distinguishing of Strowman, mean that Google could have hailed Mississippi's Attorney General into California to defend its law? Or is there a limiting principle I'm missing?
I don't know if there's a factual distinction. I think our legal rule would be that if the letter, the communication itself, delivers the cause of action, then the person has conducted purposeful availment. And that's not just our rule. That's the rule we draw from Wien Air. So if there's
thank
a fact... Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
Yep, no, you're right, the Wien Air. Thank you. Thanks, Edith. Judge Jones.
That's all right. I don't have much anything to add to this at the present time, so we'll go to Mr. Feigenbaum.
May it please the court, Jeremy Feigenbaum on behalf of New Jersey Attorney General Greer Graywall. Appellants advance a theory of personal jurisdiction that has never before been accepted in an ex parte Young case and that should not be accepted by this panel today. Appellants believe that a Texas resident can hail another state's official into Texas court to stop that official from enforcing his own state's laws in order to protect his own state's residents.
Well, let me
ask. That is wrong.
Okay, excuse me. Go ahead. Sorry.
It's okay, Your Honor. States have an interest in defending their laws and their expert courts, and they also have an interest in avoiding the inconsistent judgments across circuits that appellant's rule would generate. And as this court already explained in Strowman Realty, nothing about that analysis changes just because the state official sent that Texas resident a single cease and desist letter, warning him not to distribute a specific item to his state's residents in ways that he explains would violate his state's laws. Strowman Realty got it exactly right. That single cease and desist letter, especially one that does not provide the state official with any personal or economic benefit, does not reflect an effort by the state official to purposefully avail himself of Texas law and Texas as a forum, and is not a basis for personal jurisdiction in Texas courts. There are three pillars to my argument today, which I'll lay out, and then Judge Jones, I'm happy to entertain any questions. First, Stroman Realty is directly on point, and there's no basis to distinguish that decision in any way that would suggest purposeful availment of Texas as a forum. Second, there's no basis to abrogate Stroman Realty, which has only been strengthened by the intervening Supreme Court decisions that further cut back on effects jurisdiction. And third, the New Jersey Attorney General is not stopped from making this argument to this court. Judge Jones, I'm happy to continue, or I'm happy to entertain questions now.
Well, I have this question about the application of Stroman, which I'm pretty familiar. And that is, there's a critical difference here. The Texas timeshare company could have complied with the commissioner from Arizona's request simply by adding a footnote at the end of any of its solicitations. This does not apply in Arizona. And in fact, on the internet and in commercial law all the time in an interstate context, we see where solicitors put in footnotes, this does not apply in Montana, Arizona, California, New Jersey, et cetera. Mr. Graywall has a target far beyond that. Mr. Graywall is marching into Texas and telling the website to shut down so that Defense Distributed will not have anything on the internet. How do you reconcile that? How do you bring that under the aegis of Stroman?
Your Honor, I disagree with the characterization of what the Attorney General is trying to do in New Jersey, and I think that will help explain how we believe this case could be resolved. So as a general matter, and as we've explained, we do believe that there are ways for Defense Distributed to come into compliance that would prevent these files from ending up in New Jersey, which has always been the touchstone of the analysis. You can see that from the letter at page 178 of the record, where we talk about files being sent for use by New Jersey residents, and you can see it in the text of our criminal law, which is 2C39-9L2, which specifically only criminalizes the distribution to a person in New Jersey. So,
and I will note, of course, that Mr. Graywall was threatening criminal prosecution even before there was a criminal law.
Your Honor, in the cease and desist letter, we were focusing actually on our public nuisance law.
I understand that.
And that was our civil common law on which we were relying, not the criminal law before it had passed.
But he had also already targeted Mr. Cody, what's his name, individually.
So the sentence that Mr. Flores was referring to, which appears at 396 and 397 of the record, is from a press conference at the bill signing for the new criminal law in New Jersey. And I think it's actually important to see exactly what the New Jersey Attorney General said in the record there, because it helps to explain exactly why we believe this case is Stroman and in no way reflects targeting or purposeful availment of Texas. At that press conference, the New Jersey Attorney General, at a bill signing for a New Jersey law, says from Trenton, New Jersey, that his message is, quote, to anyone trying to sell their dangerous weapons into New Jersey, that he's trying to stop the next company like Defense Distributed and fight the ghost gun industry by making clear that selling these guns in New Jersey is illegal. There is no question that he did talk about Defense Distributed and their founder, specifically because Defense Distributed and their founder were the ones publicly telegraphing their desire to violate New Jersey law. But he made clear that from whatever state that individual resided or that company was incorporated, whether it was Arizona or California or Illinois, the tie-in was to New Jersey, and he would be going after to try to stop that dissemination all the same. There's no evidence that he was purposefully availing himself of Texas as a forum and Texas law in any of those interactions. And I think Mr. Flores' admission is telling that the only way to know from either our criminal law or our cease and desist letter that the case involves Texas is because the word Texas appears in Defense Distributed's address block. The address block is Defense Distributed's own connection to Texas, where Defense Distributed chose to take its action to post these files accessible to New Jersey residents. That was their own decision. It wouldn't have mattered to the New Jersey Attorney General whether or not this person was in Arizona or in Illinois or any other state. And at page 485 of its opinion, Stroman actually explains why that distinction would not be relevant. So in Stroman, there was also a question about whether the Arizona commissioner was trying to reach into Texas and take steps that would limit what an individual could do in terms of posting on the internet from Texas. And at page 485, this court said that it may be true that the conduct was occurring entirely in Texas. But where those interactions were involving Arizona residents, the Arizona commissioner was essentially asserting nationwide authority to prevent those interactions. That's what we have here. And that's why we believe that as a general matter, if Defense Distributed took proper steps to block dissemination to New Jersey, including...
All right. What is proper dissemination?
So one of the issues with this case...
Other than shutting down the website.
There are absolutely steps Defense Distributed could take other than shutting down the website. Right now, there are companies that distribute USB files to other individuals in person that New Jersey has never taken a position over. So if Defense Distributed maintained a website that similarly blocked access to New Jersey, that would be enough. Now, I understand Mr. Flores is going to raise questions about that, and I'd like to address them here.
How do you tell your internet service providers to block access to New Jersey?
Oh, that's something that happens in other contexts all the time. So, for example, in the casino system for online gambling, some states allow online gambling and some states don't. And so they block by IP address who's able to enter. So if your IP address comes from New Jersey.
Who is they?
In this case, the casinos, the companies. They're required by law in New Jersey right now to block anyone from New York or Pennsylvania that try to access online gambling because the laws are different in those states. And so you can't actually sit in New York City and engage in online gambling.
I'm pretty much of a technophobe, but those are not publicly accessible websites. You've got to get on those and register and possibly even be a member or pay something in order to participate, whereas this is just like a news service. This is like Yahoo News, basically.
Your Honor, it's actually quite clear that any website, even a publicly accessible one, can block IP addresses from certain locations. I don't think Mr. Flores is going to disagree with that as a technical matter. And there are other websites that have posted similar files that blocked New Jersey addresses and other states that were involved in the Washington District Court litigation. So I don't think there's any significant factual dispute that it's technically possible to block IP addresses coming in from New Jersey. And so I think that that's a significant basis to rely on for understanding that the New Jersey Attorney General is focusing specifically on tie-ins to New Jersey, and I'm certainly making that representation to you today. The facts that we'd also want to know as part of that analysis would be, did Defense Distributed encourage any of its customers to travel across the border to Philadelphia and ask them to download the files there and bring them back into New Jersey? That would certainly raise a question, but the fact of blocking the address, so long as they know that they have an effective geolocation system and they're not working to do workarounds for that system, certainly addresses the questions under a New Jersey statutory framework and goes to the heart of the public nuisance analysis that the New Jersey Attorney General was talking about.
Do my colleagues have questions?
Yes, but do you want to go with Judge Elrod first? Or?
Sure.
Okay, so you began your argument by talking about that there would be conflicts in the circuit law if this were allowed to proceed in the Western District of Texas. Haven't you already created a conflict in the circuit law, if there were to be one, by going to the Ninth Circuit instead of staying in your own circuit? So the idea that we have to stay within your circuit, you've already chosen to go to other circuits. Isn't that correct?
Not at all, Your Honor. What happened in the Ninth Circuit and in the Western District of Washington was a challenge to the federal government's rules that were being changed relative to the accessibility of these files. It was not a direct challenge to how New Jersey law would operate, how Washington state law would operate, or how Texas law would operate. And there's challenges across circuits to federal law all of the time.
Right, but the basis of the jurisdiction over this, over Defense Distributed, is the argument that we're talking about today. And it's the same type of argument that was made in Washington, in the Western District of Texas, and in the Federal Court of Appeals that governs New Jersey.
So the question in the cases we're talking about is when a state defendant can be held into court, different from when a private company can be held into court. And a state defendant is the one that's at stake in the Texas case and would be at stake in the New Jersey case, where there's already an ongoing filing. So those are the questions we're talking about.
So you don't think there's any tension that you've already created, and you think you can argue this that way. Can we please talk about the idea about the fact that it's a state defendant? You keep talking about not done for commerce and that sort of thing, but the law and order statute covers anyone who commits a tort in whole or in part in the state, and it's not limited to commercial transactions. You don't have to personally benefit it. You have to commit a tort in the state. So I don't understand the relevance of repeatedly saying, well, the Attorney General's not making any money off of this.
So that was relevant to the constitutional analysis, although it also ties into the statutory analysis. Stroman Realty actually raises that very question and answers it. In Stroman Realty, the court says, is it possible that this Ex parte Young case is about a tort? And answers squarely that the faithful application of an allegedly unconstitutional law, which is the basis of an Ex parte Young action, is not a tort in the way that that statute understood it. So that was specifically the question presented by Stroman Realty. And admittedly, although the statutory holding was dicta, it's been followed by every federal court subsequently to consider the question. So that court did draw a distinction between the application of allegedly unconstitutional laws and traditional tortious conduct. And it makes sense that the difference would apply here, because allegedly tortious conduct involves the kinds of actions that show a targeting of Texas, whereas the enforcement of allegedly unconstitutional laws simply shows that a resident of Texas is trying to enjoin application of New Jersey law.
Targeting a resident of Texas and speech by Texans. Your letter here from your attorney general would demand that you halt publication of the printable gun computer files. It is not limited to on the computer, does it? On the website. It means it would limit it, period, any publication. I don't know if you're familiar, but a number of years ago, there was a lot of litigation about the CSS descrambling DVD technology. And the students of Carnegie Mellon showed all the ways that you could publish information. They put it on ties and T-shirts. They made a film. It was to show that it's not just on the Internet. And, in fact, in this case, they used to mail this out. Would your letter apply to a mailing between two Texas residents?
No, Your Honor, it would not.
How do we know that?
We knew that from the text of the law and public nuisance law as described in New Jersey. That's the very challenge.
If you just received the letter, how would you know that it didn't apply to the library and a letter between two Texas residents?
Because of the first sentence of the letter, which says, you are directed to cease and desist from distributing these files for use by New Jersey residents. Mailing a USB file from a resident in Austin to a resident in Dallas is not for use by New Jersey residents, and you would know that from the face of the letter.
But the last sentence of the letter says, as the chief law enforcement officer for New Jersey, I demand that you halt publication of the printable gun computer files. Should you fail to comply, we will initiate immediate legal action. So if you go by the last sentence, which is one that's actually saying they're going to initiate action, I guess it's the penultimate sentence, it says you must halt any publication of the printable gun files.
Your Honor, the entire letter describes the harm to New Jersey residents, the public nuisance law in New Jersey, the assault weapons law in New Jersey, and subsequently we have a criminal law in New Jersey. The entirety of the letter and the action is a tie-in to New Jersey. I think a hypothetical might show something similar here, which is to imagine that you have a California doctor that's prescribing synthetic opioids as non-addictive, and he's doing that on a website applied to Texas residents. And the Texas Attorney General sends a letter saying, you cannot distribute these for use by Texas residents, and here's the relevant Texas law. And at the end he says, so stop distributing these. I don't think anyone believes that a doctor would be able to hail Texas's Attorney General into the Ninth Circuit to defend the validity of a consumer fraud law. And I think the same would be true in, say, the medication abortion context.
Stop distributing, period, as opposed to stop sending to people in New Jersey. You put a website disclaimer. Judge Jones had asked questions about website disclaimers. Could Defense Distributed avoid running afoul of your cease and desist by saying, New Jersey people, please do not download these files because you may be running afoul of New Jersey law?
No, Your Honor, but they could do it by blocking New Jersey IP addresses.
I don't have to do that method rather than the other. We do that for wine businesses. We do that for college gambling, other things where, well, actually most with wine, I could give example. So where you can say not eligible for people who live in this state or that state.
So there's plenty of other contexts where we don't do it. For example, we don't do it when you have the online gaming because the actual ability to access the things is right there on the computer. You don't need a second step of mailing something like you would need wine. So, for example, if someone had a law that limited access to pornography, I don't know that simply including some sort of disclaimer would be enough if there was something about that law that violated the state's law. You could have a blocking of IP addresses if the state law went further. And there's no problem with doing that in a way that demonstrates that this is really about New Jersey instead of Texas. I don't think anyone here is really disputing that the New Jersey Attorney General would have wanted to take the same action if Defense Distributed was a company incorporated in Arizona. And that shows that it's a mere fortuity that this case is about Texas and that we're discussing this in Texas federal court right now.
My last question, I, as a Texas judge, have held someone to be coming into Texas under tort law based upon one letter that they sent into upstate. Why wouldn't the Wien error case apply in this situation? And to the extent there is a tension with Stroman and Stroman can't be distinguished, that's assuming hypothetically, why wouldn't Wien error control rather than Stroman because it's under our rule of order limits? That's my last question.
Thank you, Your Honor. So I have two reasons why I believe Wien error should be distinguished, and I think that will cover both of your questions. So one, there's a qualitative difference, and then there's a quantitative difference. Wien error involved a course of conduct involving multiple misrepresentations aimed at the forum, and that's what the Wien error court specifically held. In this case, we have a single letter that was sent into Texas, and it was also a single cease and desist letter. And if you look at the decision in Halliburton, or if you even look at the explanation in Inmar, which is an unpublished decision, but obviously can carry some persuasive effect. Both of them explain in detail why the sending of a single cease and desist letter, even if it's not by an attorney general, but simply by one company, doesn't demonstrate purposeful availment because it's an effort to try to avoid litigation. The fact of New Jersey public nuisance law, the fact of New Jersey statutory law, and even the attorney general's desire to bring an enforcement action would not create a basis for jurisdiction in Texas. There might be a debate about the dormant commerce clause and how far New Jersey can go, but everyone would recognize that that fight would be had in the District Court of New Jersey, and the Third Circuit would be able to rule on those claims properly. What happened here is simply that there was the sending of a single cease and desist letter. And as Halliburton explained, even if some letters might be enough, a cease and desist letter uniquely does not make sense to show purposeful availment because it's an effort by the sender to avoid continued litigation with that party, reflecting what they believe is their right under the pre-existing law.
Let me ask, what was the nature, I understand that the nature of Graywald's contact with internet service providers was to threaten them if they did not take down this website, right?
No, Your Honor, there's two facts that I think are relevant there. So if you look at page 181 of the record, we informed the company DreamHost of the violations of their acceptable use policy, but actually there are no threats contained within. We don't even say anything beyond you should be aware that there is a violation of the acceptable use policy. I'd also note DreamHost is a California company, so to the degree that appellants are relying on effects jurisdiction here, that's walled in.
Well, but that clearly indicates that the effects would be felt in Texas. In other words, if you're able to discourage any internet service provider for this website, then you've censored the website entirely.
Your Honor, I see my time has expired. May I answer that question?
Yes.
We believe that this is exactly like Walden relative to the letter that was sent to DreamHost. It's an action that was sent to State A, where the effects were then felt in State B because that's where plaintiff was. That's exactly what happened involving the cash in Walden and what the court said is not enough under Calder for effects jurisdiction.
All right, sir.
May I ask a few questions?
I guess so. But his time has run out now. He's Judge Higginson, so...
I was just thinking there would be sequencing. I'd get my time.
Well, I didn't get my time before, so just...
All right, then I would ask any questions.
Well, you can ask a question or two, but just be succinct.
It seems to me, not surprisingly, when the issue is purposeful availment, it is a fact probe. And just listening to you both today, would you agree your arguments are converging? In other words, if the letter had clearly said there is no enforcement in Texas, I don't think they'd be saying there is jurisdiction. But if your argument says that we will enforce in Texas, I'm curious if you would still contend there would be no personal jurisdiction.
So we think that would be a completely different case, Your Honor, for the reasons that you've described. There'd still need to be an analysis of purposeful jurisdiction, of purposeful availment, to try to decide if we were aiming ourselves at Texas as a forum, or if it was a mere fortuity that Defense Distributed was there. But I agree the case would be completely different because it wouldn't have the same New Jersey tie-in.
The difficulty, though, is it seems like, you know, attorney generals, state and federal, are always expansive, and they warn, and they say, we will come get you. And when the Department of Justice does that, they know they'll have to defend the federal law anywhere. It does seem like if relevant, how do you compare the Backpage case where a county sheriff has decided to bully something he doesn't like? Why would it matter? Let's say Defense Distributes very small. What's the logic that they still have to go up to New Jersey when it's unclear if New Jersey will enforce against distribution in Texas too?
So the logic there is that to the degree that there's any question about what the law means and how far it goes, which is inherent in the kind of challenges that Defense Distributed is talking about here, it's important to have the expert courts resolving questions of the interpretation of that law, as well as then assessing its validity. Those are the very sorts of questions, simply when there's passage of a law, even without a cease and desist letter, that courts would want to be handling based on their own jurisdictions, so that you don't have the Mississippi Attorney General hailed into court in California, and you don't see cases about one state's medication abortion or consumer fraud or synthetic opioid laws challenged all across the country. And that's exactly the rule we're putting forward, that when it's a state action.
Yeah, I appreciate, but I Judge Jones was generous to let me ask questions at all, so I'll stop.
Understood, and I appreciate the opportunity to answer them. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Flores, rebuttal.
Can't.
How about now?
Yeah, now I can hear you.
All right, thank you, Your Honor. I'll start with the estoppel issue and say that we heard precious little about that now. The challenge we laid was to have New Jersey explain what is their basis. We're saying that Defense Distributed has minimum contacts in Washington. We said their only basis was control over the website, and they have no answer whatsoever. You also heard no answer whatsoever to the notion that they got an advantage from that by obtaining the temporary restraining order, the preliminary injunction, the order holding that we're necessary parties, and the final judgment. That is case closed way to solve this action without even getting into the merits. But the merits matter because we're just as strong there. Let me do one piece of case cleanup and then get into the heart of the debate. My friend talked about the Inmar case. This is an unpublished decision from this court, and the reason Inmar doesn't apply is because, quote, the activity that was attempted to regulate by its letter was employment activity occurring outside of Texas. So there, the letter isn't going into Texas, regulating things happening in Texas. It's going into Texas, regulating things outside of Texas, much like Stroman Realty. Now let me talk about the ambiguities that we have on the merits issue of minimum contacts. There's a debate between me and my friend about what exactly their policy is, and there's a debate between me and my friend about who else they're going after. If there are any ambiguities, we win that for two reasons. One is procedural, one is substantive. The procedural reason is that this is a Rule 12 motion. And if there are ambiguities about this case and they don't believe our pleadings, then the solution is to deny the motion to dismiss and litigate us on summary judgment. If Graywall doesn't believe our pleading when we say that he's not punishing anyone else, then he can try to litigate it on summary judgment, but he can't deny it here from the podium. Also, that is proven in the record already. You can see it in our brief at pages 7 and 8. We have introduced reams of record proof showing that other people have published these files, and he is not going after them. The same applies to this question of what is the policy and what he's censoring and what he's not censoring. Now, we've seen, as Judge Elrod pointed out, the last sentence in the letter is indeed an expansive prohibition on all kinds of distribution, and this is the legal point I want to make. The whole reason that the First Amendment bans threat like this is because of the chilling effect, because it is not the citizen's obligation to root out these details. Listen to the answer that you heard from my friend. At first, he said, block IP addresses. Then he said, with more complication, block IP addresses and make sure you have an effective geolocation. Then he said something different. He said, block the addresses and make sure you have an effective geolocation and make sure that there aren't people cooperating to somehow circumvent They don't have a straight answer now in Fifth Circuit. They certainly didn't have a straight answer in a district court and definitely didn't have it in the actual letter that imposes the censorship. His argument proves our point even more. This is precisely the kind of moving target that creates the speech chilling no matter what he does next, no matter what he promises next. The last thing to say is that the argument you heard at the end is that there's some type of home court advantage for states, that somehow the Due Process Clause bakes in the notion that if states go beyond their borders and they commit wrongdoing, that they somehow get the benefit of litigating at home. And that just has no place in jurisdictional analysis. This kind of argument was made in Calder, and it was rejected. Remember, Calder had two separate holdings. Justice Rehnquist wrote for unanimous court. The one we always talk about is the first holding, about how to do your traditional minimum contacts analysis and tally up the contacts. The second holding there is when the defendant had lost the main debate on purposeful availment, and they said, there are these other constitutional reasons that you should shift the balance and put a thumb on the scales, and the court holds unanimously, no. Courts don't do that. If he has an immunities argument to make, he can make it in an immunity motion. If he quibbles with the cause of action and doesn't think that the censorship should be actionable like it is under cases from the Seventh Circuit, he can make that on summary judgment, but these are not jurisdictional arguments. If the panel has any further questions, we're happy to entertain them. Otherwise, I'll close by saying this. The lessons that we have on both of our issues are simple for state officials. On estoppel, the lesson that the court would send by ruling for us is easy. If officials like Graywall want to shield themselves from what they think are far-out jurisdictional theories, all they have to do is not use those same theories as a sword against the same opponent in a case with the same jurisdictional keystone. And on the merits, the message is also simple. It's also administrable. They have one option, maybe two, but not three. One option is to stay at home and mind your own business. Don't govern conduct that happens in other states. That's what we think the answer is. The second possible option, maybe under Stroman Realty, that perhaps state officials can masquerade as federal officials and try to do something uniformly nationwide. Perhaps, we quibble, but that's not this case. This is the third case where you have targeting expressly in every way imaginable, and we didn't hear an answer from the other side about how to distinguish Calder in that respect. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you very much. We have your arguments. And we are concluded for this today.